This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Will Ferrell, who's starring in the new cop comedy The Other Guys, and Adam McKay, who directed and co-wrote the film. They first teamed up when Ferrell was a cast member of Saturday Night Live and McKay was a writer. They also worked together on the film comedies Anchorman, Talladega Nights, and Step Brothers. And they co-founded the comedy website Funny or Die. Their new film is a satire of buddy cop movies and action films. It's about the cops who aren't the action heroes of the police force. Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg play cops assigned to desk duty. Ferrell's character is a forensic accountant who actually likes paperwork, but Wahlberg, who was demoted to desk duty, wants to be back where the action is. When the film opens, two daring members of the police force, played by Samuel Jackson and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, become the heroes of the city after getting the bad guys in an action-packed chase. In this scene, they return triumphantly to police headquarters, where they're welcomed with a round of applause. Then they make brief statements. Wahlberg looks jealous and resentful. Ferrell is cheerfully taking pictures. We'll hear Ferrell at the end of the clip. Samuel Jackson speaks first.
We know. All right, listen up. We're having a celebration tonight at Butter. Brody Jenner's gonna be there, and most of you are on the list.
You're the best. Yeah. Guys, I'm gonna say something right now. We couldn't do our job if it weren't for you guys doing all the paperwork, answering the phone.
All the gunfights, all the car chases, all the sex we don't wanna have with women, but we have to all do to what you guys do. Thank you.
And we do it again and again.
Hey, you shut your face! If we want to hear you talk, I will work your mouth like a puppet. You hear me? Caspar!
Yes. Yeah.
Adam McKay, Will Ferrell, welcome back to Fresh Air. So, Adam McKay, what made you think about doing a film about cops who aren't the rock stars and who don't get to see the action?
You know, it was somewhat inspired by the guy who caught Bernie Madoff like 8 years before he really got deep into his Ponzi scheme. And everyone sort of ignored him and treated him like he was a nerd and a nudge. And it was sort of that idea, the idea that there's new types of heroes. And that's sort of a little bit what informed Will's character, a guy who loves, you know, being a paper pusher, Alan Gamble.
And did you write the part for Will Ferrell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Will had input on it. Will was working on another movie, so we didn't directly write the first script together, but he was sending us ideas in, and he came up with the idea of a guy who loves to be a paper pusher, who actually relishes it.
And Will Ferrell, if you were a cop, which you would not be, I'm sure. I don't think you're probably quite cut out for that. But if you were a cop, would you be one of those cops, one of the paper cops?
I probably would be, yeah, because I kind of – I probably would have been the guy who was like, hey, this office work needs to get done. And that's where the real glory is. Why would you want to risk being shot at out in the field when you can actually get this legitimate, crucial work done? So that whole angle seemed so funny to us.
Will's a little bit like that even as an actor in Hollywood. He's very involved in all the release forms. All the paperwork, the contracts.
Seriously?
A lot of times the line producer will use me to facilitate a lot of the paperwork throughout a film.
You'll come in at night after you've done shooting all day with Will, and he'll just be in the office just looking through documents. He has a notary that follows him around 24 hours a day.
Okay, you know? You're kidding me now. Okay.
Yes, I'm kidding.
I thought you were for real. That's terrible. Okay. All right. So I love the opening scene. It's a great satire of the obligatory opening car chase scene in cop movies. You know, there's the bullet flying in slow motion before it hits its target. The car's crashing, cars flying through the air, cars crashing through glass windows. One of the cops jumps onto the hood of a moving car. Innocent bystanders are watching in horror. And it's also quickly edited that you can't follow what's going on or who's doing what to who. So what are some of the elements you really wanted to parody in the opening?
Well, that was the idea, was the gross excess of the whole sort of modern day heroes as they're kind of perceived through movies and TV, just how sort of ridiculously over the top they are. And, you know, the real truth is cops had to stop doing high speed chases because they were doing too much property damage. So there's an agreement with most police that they go, OK, let's back off and eventually we'll catch the guy. And so at the end of our giant chase, of course, you find out that it was all over a quarter pound of marijuana, that they destroyed 40 vehicles and blew up a building.
Yeah, we actually went on a couple ride-alongs with NYPD detectives, and I kept asking the guy I was with, like, you have any crazy chase stories? And they basically said, no, we kind of lay back and know that they'll probably come back again. So don't try to be a hero. If you want to be a hero, join the fire department. So it's funny to kind of make fun of the, like Adam said, the gross excess.
One of the other things you make fun of, too, is how in cop movies the cops are always making, well, not always, but in a certain kind of cop movie, the cops are always making witty retorts just as their lives are most at risk. So can you talk about trying to write the best retorts?
We actually wrote some that it might have been a little too inside for the audience, but at one point Samuel Jackson and Dwayne Johnson crash through a bus in their car, and there's just sort of a beat where they're in the bus, and obviously he's supposed to say a funny line. At one point we had him say a line like, man, I feel a lot of pressure to say something clever right now. And that really made us laugh. But I think it was like, it's funny, you make fun of it, but you also want it to be a little funny for the audience, and that one got dead silence. But
is that why you cut it out, because it didn't test?
Yeah, you know, if something's on the fence, we'll certainly put it in, even if it doesn't play. But when it completely dies and sort of stops the energy of the movie, we will actually heed the advice of the audience in those cases.
So did you both watch cop films for inspiration in the writing and in the directing and performance?
Did you watch any, Will?
You know what? I don't know if you recall, I had mentioned to you, oh, I should watch some more kind of buddy cop movies, and Adam actually said, no, don't. I actually don't want you to. And Adam's point was, I kind of want your ideas to come from an unfiltered place of just randomness. So yeah, so I purposely and lazily didn't watch anything, and just kind of, and that's where, you know, I emailed Adam the idea for the scene of where my character gets convinced that he can shoot his weapon in the office. And that was just a random, you know, obviously the fact that I didn't have a great knowledge of all these kind of buddy cop movies, something like that was able to just pop into my head.
Will Ferrell, would you describe your look as the cop who likes to do the paperwork and the forensic accounting?
I hate to sound so simplistic in that I knew that my character would wear glasses, but that was kind of a key element. And once I found kind of the right glasses for this guy, it kind of set the character off. But that he's a guy who's very kind of well put together, but all of his suits are probably bought at the next step below, like a men's warehouse. Not quite a men's warehouse, but
Marshalls?
Maybe a Marshalls, yeah. And so he's very sensible, very prudent with his finances, and yeah, so we tried to embody that character in the look.
We said a little bit it was like Keith Olbermann with a gun, sort of the vibe.
You know, you mentioned the eyeglasses, and they're kind of like the 80s version of aviator glasses.
Yeah, they're not. They're just a little
those wire rim aviator glasses.
As soon as I found them, we forwarded pictures to Adam, and Adam was like, "That's it."
How'd you look for
them?
That's
the look. Just with the prop master, and just kind of look through a sea of glasses. And
the prop master brings it in. You don't go to like lens crafters and say, give me something very 80s.
No, I didn't do that. But I did go to I wanted to give myself a standard issue haircut, and I did go to a Supercuts in the San Fernando Valley and just walked in and got a standard haircut, and I then forwarded the pictures to Adam, and you kind of were shocked. It was a thing where we
heard Will was going to do it, and in theory, it sounded like such a great idea. But, you know, you have to remember when you're about to go into a movie, that look is what you carry for the whole movie. So
I think your quote was, we still want you to look good on camera, but the haircut was perfectly bad in a way, and we kind of had to reshape it.
Did the haircutter not know who you were?
She cut my hair for 15 minutes, and then halfway, she didn't say a word, and then finally, towards the end of the haircut, she's like, you're one of the stepbrothers, aren't you? And I said, yes. And then that's all we mentioned. We didn't talk anymore. So that was It was kind of funny.
And you didn't say, I came here expressly for a bad haircut.
No, no. I just, in fact, very few words were spoken.
So it was an awkward silence.
It kind of was. It was an awkward haircut.
Was there a dog barking in the distance?
There should have been.
No. The Other Guys is rated PG-13, and one of the things that's missing from this film, Will Ferrell, is your traditional nude scene.
Yes.
How come? Which, was it to get the rating? Or because it would have been what's the word I'm looking for?
Upsetting?
No.
Scarring?
There's actually a new law from the MPAA that if Will just shows even his naked chest, it's an automatic R.
And in some cases, NC-17.
NC-17, yes. Yeah.
No, you know what? It dawned on us later that we basically had Mark Wahlberg, who's famous for being shirtless for different reasons than me, that we probably missed that opportunity to have two iconic shirtless people not take their shirts off. So, it just didn't happen. We don't really have an explanation.
Now, there's times when Mark Wahlberg, who plays your partner, looks like he's on the verge of laughing. and I'm wondering if there's times when, Will Ferrell, you improvise something that Mark Wahlberg wasn't prepared for and it was hard for him to get through a scene.
There's one scene towards the kind of beginning of the movie that stands out in that way, which is it's kind of our opening salvos with each other to kind of establish the dynamic that he has no respect for me and doesn't think I'm a real cop.
Or a real man, for that matter.
A real man, exactly, and goes into this whole monologue about how if he was a lion and I was in a different food group, if I was a tuna, he would swim out into the ocean and eat me. That's how much he hates me. And then we just improvised this whole second. Adam kind of threw up this idea of of the fact that I'm a tuna who then figures out how to get back on land and use my resources with my tuna friends to now actively hunt lions. And that was – anyways, it's this long rant that reverses his kind of aggressive posture in a way that – where I all of a sudden get the upper hand. And that was completely improvised. And you can – there's one bit of coverage where you can see Mark's on the verge of losing it.
There's a great moment actually in the end of the movie where Michael Keaton gets Will.
Yes.
Where he says he's leaning over Will after Will's been shot and he says, I'm going to go check on Mark's character. Hold on, I got a bad knee. And he braces himself by putting his hand on Will's face to stand up. And we literally cut it to the frame, the last frame before Will laughs because he does break. So when you see it in the movie, it's down to the millisecond before he cracks.
Now, The Other Guys may be a comedy, but the explosions in it have to look real. They have to look as real as a real cop film would. And so what are some of the things you each had to learn in order to pull off the explosions and the stunts? You know, like, you know, there's like a wrecking ball that smashes into a car and then into a building, and there's cars crashing into each other. There's explosions. And
we were actually pretty thrifty with this movie because, you know, we had to shoot in New York. It was a pretty big movie. So all told, we only crashed, like destroyed like four cars.
Right.
And we were doubling a lot of cars. And that's kind of what we learned, is that even though these movies look big and excessive, our second unit guys were very thrifty with it. And when we would shoot our stuff, we really had to plan when we were going to break something because we didn't have doubles on it. It wasn't like a $200 million movie where you just do whatever you want. So that was a little surprising to us. And then the rest of it is just a lot of planning, like a lot of storyboarding. You go over it and you do safety checks. And I mean, some of this stuff's pretty scary what they do. I mean, we have a car that shoots into a building that explodes at one point and jumps another car. And sort of halfway through, you're like, oh my God, like if anyone got hurt because of this, it's just a comedy, you know? So I think that's about as far as we would ever go with those kinds of stunts. Did you learn anything, Will? Did you have a moment of inner knowledge?
Unfortunately, Mark's character has to do not unfortunately for Mark, not for me. Mark has to do a lot of the action, and I stand there and say, "Watch out!" and we should probably run. So my action consisted of running from point A to point B. Even though I guess the hardest thing I had to do was there's a scene we do a take on the good cop, bad cop scene in a buddy cop movie. But my character misunderstands and thinks that Terry says bad cop, bad cop. So Mark starts in with his interrogation, and then I get even crazier. And I basically, in one take, maybe it was two takes, but two long takes, destroy, wrestle Steve Coogan and destroy his office. And so that was the toughest bit of action I had to do.
So you said, Adam McKay, that you had to double cars because you didn't have a big budget. What does that mean?
It means you crash into one and you wreck the right side of it. And then in another scene, you turn it around so you only see the left side and you wreck that. It's real tricky stuff like that. But yeah, they do it. They reuse it. Or if there's not a whole lot of damage to it, sometimes they'll fix it in their own shop or second unit. And I mean, these guys are super crafty. They know what they're doing. So we got a lot of use out of a lot of things.
But to speak to what you were initially bringing up, Terry, the I think it is so funny because the action does look so real, and we never wink at any of that.
Yeah, there's actually a couple scenes that are pretty cool, like the slow motion shootout in the office and in the Geary building. And I mean, that was kind of our goal. Like, if you're going to do – it's the same thing we do with Talladega. If you're going to have race scenes, let's at least make them cool. So we did our best. We did our darndest with them. And I think a few times we get off some pretty cool moments.
So even though it's a comedy, you know,
why didn't you agree with my statement? That
oh no, I agree. I was gonna start describing it, but I figured how much of the movie should I be giving away? No,
we're
I love the
very
part.
Insecure.
I love the part
we're
where
insecure.
No, I love the part where Mark Wahlberg is kind of he seems to be on some kind of like roller cart or something because he's kind of shooting and rolling backwards at the same time. He's officially on
needed.
Some paper, but yeah, I won't.
That's all
that
we needed, Terry. Yeah. Just affirmation like that. That's it. Right. We work hard. We're very vulnerable.
So again, you know, it's a comedy, but the stunt had to look real, and you use the same kind of stuff that the real action movies do. So Adam McKay, that meant you had the real responsibility of making sure no one got hurt. Not the kind of thing you'd have to worry about as much in something like Anchorman. But so was that a lot to carry around?
Well, you know, all you can really do as director is sort of set a tone. And the tone I tried to set was I just constantly said safety first. Don't do anything that's risky. I constantly checked with, you know, Conrad, our second unit director, and Brad Martin, our stunt coordinator. And is there anything that's edgy? Please don't do it. Don't do it. It's not worth it. And I just kept saying that over and over again. Fortunately, you know, Conrad and Brad are like consummate pros. So they were super safety conscious. And, you know, we had there's always a couple close calls. But, you know, knock on wood, thank God no one was seriously injured and you get through it. But it's crazy. It's a part of filmmaking people don't often think about, that people do get hurt doing these insane stunts. And so that's the only thing you can do. There's some, you know, some people shoot a little looser from the hip and say, just get it done. And I just tried not to do that. And over again said, be safe. And our producers said the same thing. Will, on the other hand, had a whole different attitude about it.
I would then, behind Adam's back, tell everyone, don't listen to him. We got to get this shot. And you're fired if you don't. So between the two approaches, I think it came out pretty good.
Yeah. I wasn't happy with what he was doing, and it undermined a lot of my credibility as a director. But the movie did work out, and no one was injured. And what are you going to do? You know, Will wants the movie to be good.
Now, there's also like a financial crisis, financial scam reform theme through the movie, because the main villains are involved with financial misdeeds. And, you know, there's references to the Federal Reserve. There's a few, like, Federal Reserve and SEC jokes. like, what's it like to write jokes like that and not worry that people won't get it?
Well, you know, there's nothing that people love more than a Federal Reserve joke.
Now, don't I know?
Yeah. I mean, you can tour the Midwest for years based on prime rate and actuarial jokes. And, yeah. No, we thought that was kind of a cool thing with the reason you could do a cop buddy movie was because crime has changed so much. You have a guy like Bernie Madoff literally steal $80 billion. You have, you know, AIG steal hundreds of billions, Goldman Sachs. Crime has changed so much, and to really do a movie with like drug dealers or drug smugglers is kind of almost quaint at this point. So we wanted to have that sort of lace throughout it and yet, you know, not be too didactic or boring about it. And it fit in pretty nicely. It doesn't tend to stop the rhythm. And I think people can feel the stakes of it too. They know that it relates to all of us. It actually is high crime. So you know, it's a comedy, but you somewhat care what they're doing.
So do you have another project that you're going to be working on together now that The Other Guys is finished?
We actually want to do the Fresh Air movie.
Oh, of course. Of course you should.
We just need you to sign a release, Terry.
You've been very difficult through all the legal proceedings.
Yeah. I'm happy to play myself. It's an adventure film, right? It's an adventure film where I sit in a chair reading all day. But it's exciting.
It's going to be for IMAX. It's going to be 3D.
Yes,
it's
right.
It's a 500-day shoot.
Well, congratulations on the new one. Thanks so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having us.
Will Ferrell stars in the new comedy, The Other Guys. Adam McKay directed and co-wrote it. The film opens tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Mitchell, was recently described by Dave Eggers as one of the more fascinating and fearless writers alive. Mitchell is the author of the new historical novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. It's a bestseller in America, it topped the bestseller list in England, and was recently nominated for the Man Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious literary award. This novel is Mitchell's first foray into historical fiction, and it came as a surprise to his readers, who are used to his postmodern experimental novels. The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet begins in 1799. De Zoet has left his home in Amsterdam to work on a tiny island in Japan as a bookkeeper for the Dutch Indies Trading Company. Because he's a foreigner, he's not allowed off the island. He intends to stay for 5 years and then return to Amsterdam with enough money to be worthy of his wealthy fiancée. But on the island, he falls in love with a midwife who is considered unmarriageable because of her scarred face. David Mitchell, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start with a reading from your new book, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet.
With pleasure. It's the morning of July the 26th, 1799.
And where are we in the story at this point?
We're just at the beginning of the novel when the protagonist, Jacob de Zoet, is about to depart from the ship, the Shenandoah, that's brought him all the way from Batavia, which is modern-day Jakarta, to Nagasaki. He's sitting on the small boat that will take him from the ship to the island of Dejima, a man-made island in Nagasaki Harbour that serves as the Dutch East Indies trading post.
Okay, now for the reading.
Hatless and roiling in his blue dress coat, Jacob de Zoet is thinking of a day 10 months ago when a vengeful North Sea charged the dikes at Domburg and Spindrift tumbled along Church Street, past the parsonage where his uncle presented him with an oiled canvas bag. It contained a scarred psalm book bound in deerskin, and Jacob can, more or less, reconstruct his uncle's speech from memory. Well, heaven knows, nephew, you have heard this book's history often enough. Your great-great-grandfather was in Venice when the plague arrived. His body erupted in buboes the size of frogs, but he prayed from this psalm book, and God cured him. 50 years ago, your grandfather Tice was soldiering in the Palatine when ambushes surprised his regiment. This psalm book stopped this musket ball. He fingers the leaden bullet still in its crater, from shredding his heart. It is a literal truth that I, your father, and you, and your sister, Geertje, owe this book our very existences. Now, we're not papists. We do not ascribe magical powers to bent nails or old rags. But you understand how this sacred book is, by our faith, bound to our bloodline. It is a gift from your ancestors and a loan from your descendants. Whatever befalls you in the years ahead, never forget this psalm book. He touches the canvas bag. This is your passport home. David's Psalms are a Bible within the Bible. Pray from it, heed its teachings, and you shall not stray. Protect it with your life, that it may nourish your soul. Go now, Jacob, and God go with you. Protect it with your life, Jacob mutters under his breath. Which is, he thinks, the crux of my dilemma.
Why is that the crux of Jacob's dilemma?
Well, the dilemma is that at this point in Japanese history, whenever a European came ashore to man the trading post, any Christian artifact, a crucifix or St. Christopher or a Bible or indeed a psalm book, they were supposed to surrender them to the Japanese authorities. They'd be sealed in a barrel for the duration of the visitor's stay on Dejima and only handed back on their departure. For Jacob, who's a pious, God-fearing young man, this is tantamount to apostasy. And even though he's a very honest man who's never broken a rule in his life under ordinary circumstances, he can't obey this rule. It would be like spitting on an image of Jesus, and he just can't do it. So he's having to smuggle this psalm book ashore amongst his other books, and he's just hoping that it won't be noticed, because if it is, he doesn't really know what will happen to him.
Why did the Japanese not allow Christian artifacts of any sort onto the island that you write about?
That's a deep historical question, Terry. They had a fear and loathing of the Christian religion. In the 17th century, Spanish and the Portuguese, Jesuits and Franciscans, were very active in proselytizing in Japan and converted certainly a low number of millions of Japanese people to the religion. There was an uprising, a peasants' rebellion, and this quickly acquired the hue of a Christian revolution, really. And from that point on, the Edo authorities realised that this foreign religion would be threatening the status quo, which they were very happy with. And so increasingly there were anti-Christian laws passed, culminating, in fact, in the closure of the country to all foreigners except a handful of people working for the Dutch East Indies Company, hence the novel.
Would you describe the island of Dejima that part of your novel is set on and its place in history?
Sure. Well, the island of Dejima was very small, that's the first thing to say about it. Probably a third of an acre, maybe half an acre. Space for 15, 20 warehouses, garden, and a long street. It was in the shape of a flipped open fan with a short bridge connecting it to the mainland. Its place in Japanese history is very interesting. For 250 years, Dejima was the only trading post through which Europeans could trade with Japan, specifically the Dutch East Indies Company. And through it passed, obviously, goods, materials, but also ideas and knowledge. Knowledge about Europe and, indeed, what was happening in the rest of the world could enter Japan, and knowledge about this mysterious kingdom that was closed to the outside world, a little bit like North Korea is closed to the world now, but I think much more so, in fact, because there would have been no smuggled-out footage for YouTube or anything back in those days.
Why did you want to set your novel on this island?
Well, it seemed fascinating to me. People do know Japan was closed on the whole. If they've seen James Clavell's Shogun or something like that, that's fairly common knowledge. But it isn't widely known that actually it wasn't, that there was this little keyhole that was kept open the whole of the time. It's a place where the two cultures could meet, the only place where Western culture and Japanese society could meet. The Dutch were very circumscribed, however. They weren't allowed to leave Dejima, and the only three types of people allowed on were merchants and courtesans and translators, who were a father-to-son kind of business. And this confinement was attractive. If there's no way off, if there's no way out of the situation, then human neuroses have no choice but to bloom and bear their own dramatic fruit. So, yeah, there were a lot of baits that attracted me as a novelist that made my curiosity say, this is your next book.
It must have been so difficult to live in such a small place and not be allowed off it. It's almost like being on a penal island.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. It was, and contemporary accounts say how mind-bendingly tedious the days were, especially out of the trading season. So the ship would arrive beginning of the trading season, which would have been June, July, and it had to be away before the seas became dangerous towards the end of autumn. And between those times, there was really not very much to do there for the Dutchmen. They spent a lot of money on prostitutes, men being men, but the isolation would have been quite incredible, I think. It would be hard for us to grasp it now. Obviously, no phones, no letters, no email, obviously, nothing. And no guarantee, of course, that the ship would be arriving safe and sound at the beginning of the next trading season. In fact, during the Napoleonic Wars, when the British were merrily seizing Dutch shipping all over the world, the Dutch were stranded there for 5 or 6 years,
not sure why, which was no word from the outside world, not knowing if they'd ever see home again. Of course, what was very, very hard for them is very attractive to a novelist at the beginning of the 21st century. So these circumstances were another reason that drew me to the book.
You made your reputation as an experimental writer, experimenting with form and language. And so this is a historical novel, and it's you know, it's pretty straightforwardly told. The midwife in this novel at one point thinks the belly craves food, the tongue craves water, the heart craves love, and the mind craves stories. And she thinks stories make life tolerable, at least make her life, which is very difficult, tolerable. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to write a historical novel, just to tell a really good story?
I'm certainly a plot and character man. Themes, structures, style, they're valid components of the novel, and you can't complete a book without them. But I think what propels me as a reader, the meat and potatoes, if you will, of plot and character, I think we think in terms of stories. I think the story is sort of the most ancient form of human entertainment. I think it's through stories that we perceive the world. It's through stories that we communicate with one another, whether it's in the somewhat refined form of the novel or just a joke that you tell a friend in a bar. I think we are narrative animals. I think that's what Homo sapiens is.
So why did you want to write a historical novel?
Well, really, because I found Dejima, and Dejima hasn't existed for 160 years as a working trading post, and so to do justice to that theme, I had to go back in time. I thought it'd be relatively straightforward. I thought historical fiction was just one more genre, but little did I know. I went wrong twice and had to throw aside about 18 months worth of work at one point, but eventually, by going wrong, I slowly began to work out how I could go right, and this historical novel grew out of that.
What was one of the mistakes that you made when you went wrong?
Language. That was the biggest, baddest mistake, really, Terry. What language did these people speak in? If you try to get it right, if you try to get authentic 18th century speech, you end up sounding like Blackadder. You end up sounding like pastiche. If, on the other hand, you don't convince your reader that the language, you know, smells authentic, then a bubble of fiction is popped because the reader's thinking, hang on, this sounds like speech that could have been from a sitcom I saw last week. So you have to sort of create what I came to think of as a bygone-ese kind of dialect, which is not, in fact, completely plausible. It doesn't really work if you have characters using the word hearken, for example, but which still smells and has the right texture of 18th century speech. And it's tough to do that. It's tough to work out exactly how to do it.
And then you have to be consistent once you've figured it out.
Well, you have to be consistent, and then, of course, you have to avoid the trap where my rather large cast in this book, I think someone somewhere worked out there's about 150 speaking parts in it, they mustn't all sound the same, because that also pricks the bubble of fiction. That also makes the reader think, why are all these people speaking the same voice? That doesn't happen in life. So you have to work out bygone-ese, but then subdivide it amongst the Dutch, the Japanese, the British.
It sounds like you really made life hard for yourself.
Oh, I did. I do. But of course, it's those strictures. It's that straitjacket. The better tied straitjacket, the more spectacular the act of escapology has to be to get out of the straitjacket. And maybe that's what originality is. It's the confinements that you choose at the beginning, rather like the confinements that the Dutch were under on Dejima, in fact.
Well, I'm glad you brought up originality because, you know, earlier on you were playing with conventional narrative in your novels. Did you start to feel at some point that the attempt to be original was kind of hopeless because everything's been tried, every experiment's been done, and at some point what you want to do is just be really, really good at whatever whatever it is you're doing?
Well, I do aspire to be that. It's a lifelong job, though, before you're worthy to sweep up the crumbs under the table of the musters.
But do you know what I mean? Sometimes, like when I was in my early 20s, I guess, I got so excited by avant-garde music, by new music, by the avant-garde end of classical music, and because they were playing with structure in a way that I found so thrilling. And also, you didn't have to know everything about classical music to get what they were doing. Maybe if I knew more, I would have gotten more of it. But at some point, I wanted more melody in my life and more more harmony in my life.
Sure. You want to be able to hum the tune, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I think it's natural for youth to be drawn to newness because the world is still new for them, and there's a feeling that you can take part in shaping it and changing it and turning it into something new in your image. But then you age, inevitably. I look in the mirror now and I think, wow, it's Dad. And and I am a dad and I am a husband. And these sort of messy, human, muddy themes become much more interesting. And you also realise that structure, originality and innovation is not actually a story. They're useful ingredients for art, but it's not art itself, not really. You might be able to admire it, but you certainly can't fall in love with it as a piece of music or as a piece of narrative. Yeah, you go back in a way to older, more traditional forms. You also come to accept that actually Shakespeare cleaned everything up. There's no new turf after him, really. All the postmodern themes, the play within the play, metafiction, it's already been done in the 17th century. You can't win. But art isn't the what, art is the how. Lowell said this really well. If you try to write about the universe, you'll end up staring at the bricks at the bottom of your garden. But if you start with those bricks, you may well end up writing something new about the universe. To start with the people. People are why I fall in love with a book. If you start there, then you can kind of allow ideas and maybe allow innovation and a new structure to sort of grow organically from these stem cells of people. But I think you need to start with the people and how they interact, which is your plot.
You've written about how, as a boy, you had a very bad stammer. Mm. And there's still, I guess, elements of that left, but...
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah.
It's my lifelong companion.
You write something I thought was very funny and very true. You wrote, "The willpower myth maintains that a stammerer is analogous to a newly wheelchair-bound character in a heartwarming American film. The doctor says he'll never walk again, but his gritty determination proves them wrong. This myth, you say, cost me angry years of believing that I stammered because I wasn't trying hard enough not to stammer." Would you describe what you tried to do during those angry years?
Firstly, I should apologise for the adjective American in that sentence because the British are also equally capable of making such films.
okay.
What I went through in those years, sort of a state of civil war with myself, really. It took a long, long time to understand that a stammer is more like a kind of a force field. And the more you throw at it, the more it throws back at you. You sort of have to outwit it rather than outfight it. And in a way, not even outwit it. You sort of, I think of it now as a kind of a companion. It's a part of me. It has a right to exist, as I do. And I need to sort of come to a working accommodation with it. A friend who was an alcoholic once said to me that an alcoholic never stops being an alcoholic. But what you have to aspire to be is a teetotal alcoholic. And in the same way, a stammerer, I think, certainly in my case, will never not be a stammerer, but you have to aspire to becoming a non-stammering stammerer. And this involves certain strategies and techniques that you can sort of encrypt into how you speak so that I'm able to do this interview, for example, which 20 years ago would have been unthinkable. And in the end, these strategies can become so well integrated into who you are and how you speak that they become behaviour and speech patterns rather than techniques.
So do you find it's better for you to say up front to people, yeah, I've got a stammer, so that's the way it's going to be?
Oh, much more so, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a huge weight off your shoulders, yeah.
Well, that's something you had to hide when you were young?
Most certainly, all the time. Being a teenager is hard enough at the best of times, but if you're a stammering teenager, then and if it's known and if you're sort of exposed as a stammering teenager, then it's really tough. So I spent a lot of energy and a lot of angst and a lot of stress trying to hide it, and yeah, throughout my 20s as well. But in the long run, it's much, much better for me, at least, to be upfront about it.
It must have been so frustrating because you're Mr. Language. You know, I mean, you're all about language. And when you opened your mouth, it wouldn't come out smoothly. Yet I'm sure you were writing even as a teenager. And
frustrating, yes.
So people would make fun of you because of your stammer, yet you probably knew so much more about language and were so much more facile with language than the people who were mocking you.
In part, yes, because of my stammer. This is why I view my stammer now as a companion and not an enemy. I might have been a writer without it, but I certainly wouldn't have been this writer. One of the strategies I was referring to, which you meet quite early on in your career as a stammerer, is you auto-cue sentences ahead of time. You see what words are coming up, and say right now I'd have difficulties with words beginning with S. Certainly as a younger person, if I saw an S word was approaching, then I would try and re-engineer that sentence to avoid needing that S word. And this teaches you how language can be employed many, many different ways to say the same thing.
Now, you lived for 8 years in Japan and taught English there to Japanese students.
Yeah.
But from what I've read of your personal essays, you never really spoke fluent Japanese, and you always felt a little challenged by that. So how did that affect your stammer, being like having to really think what each word was before you said it because it wasn't your language? Did that make the stammer any better or worse?
I think the practical problems of learning Japanese would probably sort of trump, by this point, the problems that my stammer would cause me. So, not particularly. You do stammer in a foreign language, by the way. People sometimes think you don't, but you do. You don't stammer when you're singing or talking to animals or speaking on your own in a room, but you do stammer in a foreign language.
You don't stammer when you're talking to animals?
No.
You see,
it's all
that?
To do with... I've thought about this a lot, but I think, and you may have some speech therapists listening to this program who could have a different point of view, but it's to do with what you think is going on in the listener's head. If you can have a certain militancy about it, if you can think that, I frankly don't care if I'm about to stammer or not. I don't care if this person thinks I'm weird. I don't care if this person thinks any less of me. Then, miraculously, kind of the fingers of the stammer loosen and suddenly you're more fluent again. Obviously, an animal isn't thinking in these terms. So when you're speaking to an animal, you don't stammer. This is also why it's good to be upfront about it. If there's no question before you start that, hey, I am a stammerer, it's out in the open, and I may well stammer in this conversation. If that's there before the conversation starts, then as often as not, the stammer will be a lot lighter and looser in that conversation.
You know, I'm thinking, you have this problem with a stammer, so speaking has always had obstacles and the threat of failure, right?
Yeah.
And you're a writer, like language is your thing. So what do? You spend 8 years living in a country whose language is so different from yours, setting up yet another set of obstacles for communicating verbally through language. It almost seems like the stammer wasn't enough. You had to set up more obstacles. You had to make it a little bit harder.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe I thrive on obstacles. Yeah, there might be something in that. But I think originality needs it. A book that's easily written, you know, you can always tell when the writer hasn't broken out in a sweat trying to land this book. And maybe something of the same can be said in life. If life is obstacle-less, if you're just coasting along without responsibilities, without duties, without sort of having to take care of an elderly relative or an offspring with special needs or whatever. Well, perhaps that's what existential malaise is. Maybe that's sort of when you start to drift and have problems of another type. Maybe your problems and your obstacles, rather like your stammer, is in fact a kind of friend in disguise for you. I don't know if we're venturing into self-help territory too much here, but it's something that I kind of believe in.
Well, David Mitchell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me on your program.
David Mitchell is the author of the novel The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. You can read an excerpt of the book and Maureen Corrigan's review of it on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.